Hi, this is Joe Patty. Thanks for listening to WRTI Online. This service is made possible through the support of WRTI's members. You can become a member, too. Since you're already online, just visit www.wrti.org and click the Become a Member link. You can also join us by phone at 1-866-809-9784. Your membership will help keep WRTI's broadcast and online services strong. And again, thank you. Now, on with the show.
The Canadian group La Pietà was founded in 1997 by violin virtuoso Angèle Dubois, who is the concertmistress and also the director of the group. Miss Dubois is our guest today here on Crossover, where we'll discuss her newest release on the Analecta label, Philip Glass Portrait. A very exciting new release, and you're paying tribute to Philip Glass and his film music, I guess, isn't it, in this album?
Yes, well, of course, Philip Glass is one of the icon of contemporary music. And when you see, the catalog of Mr. Glass, he's a very, very prolific composer.
Yes.
And of course, like you were saying, some works are linked to movie, to theater, and it gave me, you know, a large, variety of choice for the repertoire of this portrait. And for me, it was very, very important when I started to look all and to re-listen to all the music of Mr. Glass, first to find, of course, works that fit for strings,
yes,
which is my orchestra,
yes,
and to add here and there piano or harp or, you know, color, I would say, or texture. And of course, I wanted also to have beautiful and significant works from Mr. Glass. So that's the portrait.
Yeah. Well, you certainly achieved all of your ends in this album. It's very, very beautiful. I didn't expect it to be as accessible as it is, and it's a highly intellectual journey listening to Philip Glass. It's good to know about what he's trying to say before you listen, because I think the initial impact for someone who is not educated in his music is one of just, you know, kind of a repetitious, what's minimalism, of course, repetitious, and what is he doing? What is he doing here? But I was going to ask you, as a musician, what are the mm-hmm. challenges of playing this minimalist music? I am a musician myself, and I know what it is. When the score is written out, if you just listen, it's the same thing over and over and over again. But when it's written out on the score, I believe the bar marks change, I think, very often. So
well,
what happens is the first beat is not the first beat again.
Exactly.
Yes, it's, you know, terrible.
It's terrible. It's you know, it's the kind of music that is almost hypnotizing when you play it.
Yes, and you're not supposed to listen. You can't listen really too much.
Oh, you have to be concentrated really, really, really hard. And it's a music very well conceived, I would say very well structured, like you were saying. It's Cartesian, very mathematical.
Yes.
And when you play it as a musician, first you have to find the rhythmic cell. I would call the steam cell, the stem cell.
The stem cell, okay.
Stem cell, yeah. That, then this cell can be add, superpose, juxtapose, you know, in stratum. And it's like rhythms in two, juxtapose on rhythms on three, four,
yes,
five.
Yes.
And you have to find a point of anchorage, of this music. You know, it's like almost to find a common denominator, you
yes,
know, like
yes,
very mathematic.
Yes, it is.
But of course, it's not only mathematics. It's the emotion comes after, and it's on this solid structure, stratums of color or texture. You know, the sound is add. You have to color the sound, and it's just like, you know, like you were saying, the repetition. It's just like a mantra. You know, it's something that. It's mesmerizing
yes,
music.
Yes, it is.
Know?
Absolutely yeah. mm-hmm. mesmerizing. You find yourself, it's compelling, but very relaxing, believe it or not. I just think of you as a musician playing this. I know I had an experience with The Chairman Dances by John Adams, and it was just impossible, you know, to figure. It's the same kind of thing where you have this minimalist repetition over and over and over again, and then the lyrical melody floating above it. But when you're playing it, it's not the same as when you're listening to it.
It's not, and like I was saying, it requires a tremendous concentration, but also you have to step back from your immediate, you know, personal emotion. You have to make a room into yourself just to be calm and to get the fulfillment to that the music after can habit, you know, yourself.
How do you find that center that you're talking about? It's very, very difficult. You have to kind of concentrate on that one
concentrate
thought.
Yeah, exactly, and you have to concentrate on the structure of the music, and then, you know, as for me, it's quite challenging when I play Philip Glass, because as you know, in addition to be the violinist and soloist, I have to conduct, you know, the ensemble at the same time, so I have to develop my I would say my own internal metronome, you know.
Yes.
Just to be able to find those rhythmic structure that I was speaking before, and then I have to communicate this pulsation to the other musician.
That's exactly like an undulating sound and this throbbing that goes on and on and on, and the other thing is that just listening to it objectively, there was a sense, I guess it's because it's strings, I think that's the reason. There's kind of like the feel of the quartets of perhaps late Beethoven or I don't know, there's a sense of Brahmsian kind of sound there. I don't know, it's just something that sounds very, 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 very much like classical music that we are, you know, used to hearing in another framework.
Well, of course, you know, my playing with La Pietà for this Philip Glass recording is a revisit of his you know, beautiful works of Mr. Glass. But it's played, like you were saying, with classical formation, you know.
Yes.
It's a string ensemble with add of piano or celesta or harp here and there. So it's all in color. It's all in emotion. Yes, it can, you know, music can, put you to a thing of other composers, as you know, maybe Philip Glass was inspired by some Beethoven quartet, like
I'm
you were
sure.
saying,
yes.
And who's not anyway?
Yeah,
but
<that's right>.
But that's you know, right. We just live with our baggage of Renaissance.
Right. So right, but exquisite. I mean, I was really. I'm going to say the word surprised at how much I was taken with this wonderful portrait that you did. It's a beautiful, beautiful album. We have, as
Thank
I
you.
Said, played other works of La Pietà, your group, your ensemble, which are rather unorthodox in terms of varied, you know. I mean, they're lighter fare or, you know, beautifully played once again.
I like to pick up my repertoire from different eras, different style, and of course seeing it's a look that I gave to myself many years ago. But seeing my repertoire with no limit of choice, you know, the freedom to play what I want, what I like, is really important for me. And of course, it gives me a huge choice of works. And the core, of course, is classical repertoire.
Yes.
But I like also to go and juxtapose pieces of other style, and I go to Piazzolla, Morricone, here now, you know, it with Philip Glass, and why not? It's beautiful.
It's all wonderful music. Yes, it is, and as I say, the ensemble is so fine. Technically, it's really a joy to listen to. And again, I was not at all. When I got the album, I said, okay, Philip Glass. And then I listened to it. So it's really quite delightful. Can you just tell the audience a little bit about your background, where where you studied and so on?
Sure. Well, I started the violin at the age of 4. I'm number 7 of an 8 children family.
Oh, my.
Yeah. And all my brothers and sisters all went through, you know, music. Of course, I have one brother who is now still doing music and teaching and playing piano. But the rest of my family just went elsewhere. But they still play, and they still for sure enjoy listening to music. So, and as for my studying, I started to study in Montreal at the Conservatoire in Montreal.
Yeah.
Yeah, conservatoire. And then I came to Juilliard in New York. After I went to Europe, I went to Romania to study with Stefan Gheorghiu anyway. And, you know, like every soloist, I started with competition, national competition, then international competition. And, you know, one day you discover that if you work very, very hard, you will have a place under the sun. So, and I'm still working to keep this place.
You certainly have. So thank you so very much for speaking with us. Any other plans after this album? Anything on the burner?
Well, more concert, more CDs, you know, it's really, I'm very, very, I'm a fulfilled woman because I'm very happy. And when I look back or when I look to the future, it's more music to discover. Thank you.
Oh, yes. Well, certainly. Okay. And thanks once again.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. We've been speaking with French-Canadian violin virtuoso Angèle Dubois, concertmistress and conductor of the ensemble La Pietà. Today we've been previewing an album of the music of Philip Glass. Truly, Glass's film music makes so much sense when coupled with the images on screen and the impetus that drives the behavior of his characters. We're also delighted today to revisit an interview with Mr. Glass, which we did several years ago and retrieved from our precious crossover archives. How do you describe your music? I know I'm not even going to
use it. You know, I have the way of describing it, which has the virtue of being actually very truthful. I write theater music.
Yes, well, I think it's very theatrical. Certainly, your film scores are.
Well, yeah, I consider theater to be opera, dance, ballet, and film because all of those elements they're all theatrical uses of music. It's where you take image, text, movement, and music, and combine them into
meaningful,
collaborative, intermedia kind of discipline. And in that way, film is not that different from opera. I was in L.A. not too long ago with some film composers. I was invited to talk to them about writing music for film, and one of them said, "What's the difference between film and opera?" And I said, "Not much."
What is the difference?
Not much. you know, if you look at a screenplay, it looks like an opera libretto. They look the same.
Okay.
The difference is that people don't sing. They talk. That's a big difference. And the other big difference is that there's a big boss around there who tells you how they want it to sound. And when you write an opera, no one tells you what to do.
Well, I was going to say, your kind of music, how do you write for the opera? In that sense. Now, if you write for film, and of course you're talking about visuals and so on.
I start from the text. So this is not the way I began writing operas. With I Saw on the Beach, there was no text. And, I'm now up to opera. I've just completed opera number 20. I've written a lot of operas.
Many operas.
And it's evolved over the years. I began not worrying about the text at all, and I just worried about images and music. And midway through, by the time I was writing the Cocteau operas, I did three of those in the late 80s and early 90s.
Right.
By the time I got to that point, I was very involved with text. And now when I look at opera, I spend a lot of it. I would say that it really does begin with the word, in the sense that the word is the narrative. That doesn't mean that they're narrative operas. I just did an opera with Bob Wilson in New York in 1998 called The White Raven, which is fairly recent.
Yes.
And it was a completely non-narrative opera. In other words, it was an opera that doesn't tell a story in a linear way. That's what I mean by non-narrative. You tell a story, but it's not a linear story. It's a different way of telling a story. You use images, you use fragments of conversations, you use movement, and you kind of tell the story not going from A to B, but kind of circling around it, going around in a circle and coming to the center. That's how Bob and I have always worked. So there are different ways of working with opera, both narrative and non-narrative, but I would say that for me the source of the music is somehow what happens on the stage. Let me put it that way. Even if it may not be a text, though it very well could be, but it's somehow the unfolding of the theatrical event, as it's as it's communicating to us some idea about a person or an event, that becomes the source of the opera, and I base the music on that.
Now, technically, though, you write a vocal line, and then, of course, you write an orchestral line. What is...
No, that may not be true.
No?
It could be the other way around. It could be... I'm not saying this to be contrary, but in fact, because this is what very often will happen, I will look at a scene. I just did an opera about Galileo.
Yes, the Galileo Galilei.
Just last year, year before. And there was a scene, for example, where there's a letter that we all know about, the letters of Galileo's daughter, and we set one of these letters to music. I did, and Mary Zimmerman staged it. Now, I read the letter, but I didn't set the letter. First I read the letter. Then I wrote, and then I knew that it would be a scene in which it's kind of like a Romeo and Juliet scene where she's in the balcony and he's down below. I mean, that's about as far, you know, in the sense that we see her above and we see him below, but she's singing. So mm-hmm. I knew it would look like that. And then I wrote the music for the scene. And after I wrote the music for the scene, I set the words to the music. So you can do it that way, too.
But musically, you don't think that way. I mean, I can see how the sense of the words, but musically, do you think that way?
I'm completely able to do that, and I mm-hmm. often do it that way. In other words, I wrote all the orchestral music, and then I wrote the melody. Actually, it's a good way to do
yes,
it.
Yes, that is very interesting.
Because it narrows the vocal, the choices that you make. With the text have to do with where, how close you want to be to the harmony or not. Mm-hmm. For example, and that can change. For example, with an opera in French, it might work very differently than an opera in English.
Right.
The language itself tends to work a little more obliquely with the musical. With the harmonic material than it might in English. I don't know why that is, but it does work out that way.
Well, I think also when they translate opera into English, it's very awkward because the words, the language
it's better,
does dictate.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. So I try to work in the original languages when I do mm-hmm. Anyway. But
what about your film work? What does Katsi mean, by the way?
Katsi means life.
Life.
But we're talking about Hopi Indian language, and I don't speak a word of it, except I do know one or two words. And Kalinas Katsi, there are three,
yes.
Kalinas Katsi, Paul Katsi, Nakur Katsi.
I love the last one.
Yeah. And did you see it?
No, but I have the film score, and I was very impressed with it.
Well, Katsi means life, so it always means life as, Kalinas Katsi meant life out of balance. The second one was life as one form of life consumes another. And the third one is not kurikasi, is life as violence, as civil violence, which is a very scary subject. And and we happen to be making it right during we were actually in the post-production phase of it when 9/11 happened.
My goodness.
And that was completely...
Did it affect what you... Did you feel what you wrote?
We stopped working for two... Well, the film was done. The music was done. We were all done. We were just basically putting... we were doing the fine edits, the most... You know, the final things on September the 11th, and we stopped work for 2 weeks. We didn't know what to do. Because it happened that in the film, we had already had images of the Twin Tower. There were always images of it with explosions behind it.
Yes.
That was in the movie. It had done it 6 months
well,
before.
You were ESP of some kind.
Godfrey has it. Godfrey's the one that has it.
There were
images of Bin Laden in the film.
My goodness.
Which he had gotten from somewhere.
Isn't that scary? Don't you think that's really quite something?
Godfrey has always done that. Godfrey has that ability to look in. I think he does. He claims he doesn't. He gets very nervous when I say that. He doesn't. He hates it when I say, well, Godfrey, I said, you have that ability to lift the curtain and look into the future. Very few of us can do that, but you do it. He says, no, I can't do it. But he's invariably done that. The Kalinas Katsi ends with, a space shuttle blowing up. It happened 6 years before the Challenger.
Unbelievable. Well, there is something there.
He has a visionary. He really is.
Yes.
And he And it's amazing what happened. So we stopped for 2 weeks. And we finally went back to work, and in the end, we brought the movie out, and I encouraged them. I said, just leave it the way it is. I said, in 10 years' time, the coincidence of the events will have disappeared, and the film will exist by itself. It's only existing in relation to 9/11 at that moment, right?
Right.
But even 2 or 3 years later, the coincidence of events will have disappeared, and by 10 years, it will have become... I said, I think it will take a while till people see it, without seeing it in the context of what happened of that year. But in the end, the film will be seen on its own. That's my feeling. I may be wrong.
Well, also, I guess the perception, when you see it closer to the event, though, it has a tremendous impact. I would think people, the perception of what's going on is
people
influenced.
Frankly, people were freaking out. The film did not have a long run. People are listening to the music, but the film had a very limited run. It came out a year later.
But it had an enormous impact, if you'll pardon the
pun. Which one?
Koyaanisqatsi
startling.
That's
been going on.
Oh,
that's been going on.
Yeah.
I've done that live 200 times. I was talking about not Koyaanisqatsi when it came out. No one wanted to see it. Mm-hmm. In fact, when Koyaanisqatsi came out, no one really wanted to see it. It did take a while for people to look at it.
But that was a very new, that was so new what you did.
Yeah, it was.
When I listen to just some of your music, I say, I get this, well, of course, there's a tremendous Eastern influence, I feel, but there's like a, I don't mean this as a criticism, a nothingness, a facelessness.
I know an emptiness about it.
It's really, and it just permeates everything.
I like that myself.
Yes, but it's really amazing. You get that. And then you have...
And at the same time, it's always recognizable as me somehow.
Oh, yes.
Now, how could that be? I have no idea why that happens that way.
And you know what? Harmonically, my limited knowledge, it's very simplistic in some ways. Certainly the film score that I listen to, the... Koyaanisqatsi.
Yeah.
It seems like you have in certain like triads or something.
Of course,
and you play them. Yeah,
yeah.
You know, you're just playing
no
them.
Big
open.
Deal.
Yeah, no big deal. And
no
yet,
big deal.
There's this tremendous, but it goes on and on and on. And then this wonderful cello voice comes in and it is mesmerizing.
Yeah.
It really is. And I would imagine that it's very good. Well, actually, I must tell you this. I did some research on music therapy for a project, and your music was recommended to be used to put you in an altered state.
Is that
several
right?
of your works were suggested for that. This is healing music. Music
did you
for
try
healing.
It?
No, but I will tell you this. When I listened to the soundtrack, I relaxed quite a bit, and then, of course, there was one section, this point blank. That was rather interesting. It was kind of a popsy rock
with a vocalist in it.
Yeah, very, very interesting. An excerpt from my crossover interview of March 2003 with iconic minimalist composer Philip Glass.